I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
While the Democratic presidential candidates debated in Miami, we'll see if their Georgia campaigns are ready for the battle here. Meanwhile, Atlanta's mayor goes to Washington to ask for help in the fight against cyber hacking, but before she went, she unveiled an affordable housing plan. Critics argued it's not very specific. And Atlanta's immigrant community waits to see if President Trump's threatened raids will actually happen. We've got all that and more on the table for this political breakfast. It is a pleasure to have your company. Brian Robinson is here. He's a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff to former Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is away this time, filling in. We have Gwinnett County Democratic Chair Bianca Keaton, and I'm Dennis O'Hare. Hello to both of you, and welcome to Bianca Keaton, who's with us for the first time.
Thank you for having me.
Good Friday morning.
Let's start with something that was raised during the Democratic debates that we just heard. Bianca, I'm going to start with you. Whoever wins the nomination, even if he or she is elected, and we heard a little bit about this during the debates, won't be able to get much done if the Democrats don't control the Senate. Georgia's one of the states the Democrats had hoped to flip. So as you're developing your strategy at the county and state levels, do you say to those presidential candidates, fine, y'all come through, we'll help you however we can, but we need to focus on the Senate in terms of organizing, in terms of money?
Absolutely. We definitely need to be focused on our Senate candidates. And luckily for us in Georgia, we have up to fine Democratic candidates that are jumping out there in Teresa Tomlinson and Sarah Riggs Amico, who hasn't quite launched.
Right.
But she will be out soon. So I'm really excited about that contest.
Has she said that? Or are we making news here?
I think she's going to jump in. I won't, you know, cast any, you know, persuasions here. But I do think she's going to jump in.
Okay. Back to the strategy question.
Yes. It's very important for those of us on the ground to not be distracted by what's going on with this widely enormous and perhaps unprecedented presidential nomination race. We need to be building our infrastructure on the ground. And, you know, quite frankly, the presidential candidates should be helping us build that infrastructure, because if they really want to defeat Trump, you know, no matter what, you know, win or lose, then they would be helping us build that infrastructure and spending more time in communities outside of the urban center.
And have you gotten any indication that either the National Party or any of the candidates are willing to throw money specifically at the Senate race as long as the field of candidates is a little vague at this point?
We wouldn't know about money being thrown for specific races. As far as our organizing is concerned, even from the local level, we don't do federal. We don't focus on federal candidates. Mm-hmm. Our focus is state and below.
Brian, GOP State Chair David Schaefer recently was quoted in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution as expressing great worry about the Democratic organizing efforts at the grassroots. I'm sure money won't be a concern for David Perdue, but Schaefer was saying, well, they're out organizing us a little bit. You're an old University of Georgia guy. You remember Vince Dooley, who always talked up the opposition before a game. Is David Schaefer sandbagging a little bit here?
This is not the University of Georgia talking up Nickel State's football's prowess. No, not at all. This actually reflects what I have been saying for a long time here on this podcast. the Democrats have been taking Georgia more seriously than Republicans have. And this is something I say not only on the air, but I say it in private meetings with Republican elected officials and with party operatives. I just got out of a meeting before coming here, actually, meeting with some folks helping with the Trump effort for 2020. The Democrats did a great job in 2018, and Stacey Abrams really does get the credit for this.
Thank you.
Well, yeah. Look, I always give her credit for where she's right. That should give me credibility when I point out that she's not telling the truth about stealing the election and all that voter fraud crap. None of that's accurate.
Oh boy.
But what Democrats did extraordinarily well in 2018, and they have an advantage that Republicans don't have here, is they're able to target low propensity voters who are more likely to vote Democrat if they were to go vote, and they're finding them in these apartment complexes that are popping up in Bianca's Gwinnett County in North Fulton, up the Georgia 400 corridor and up the I-75 corridor. So you're seeing a lot of these apartment complexes with millennial and now Generation Z voters who are multiracials, not white, black, Latino, Asian, everything. And they're going in there. They had, I think, 200 paid grassroots organizers who just did apartments in Metro Atlanta in 2018. That is an impressive show of force by the Democrats, and it worked. We are in a tight race. David Schaefer is right, and I think David Schaefer is probably a great man for the job because he is a political animal at heart. He's not going to want to lose. He's going to have his pride on the line, and I think he's going to do a lot to get us organized and get our ground game going.
Very quickly, Bianca, Stacey Abrams was in Washington talking about her allegations that there was active voter suppression in Georgia during the 2018 election. Republican Georgia Congressman Doug Collins was on that committee. He pointed out, as Brian has often pointed out, that voter turnout, especially among minorities, has jumped in Georgia, and that is evidence that nobody was suppressed. And so I wanted to get you to respond to what Brian said.
Okay. How does that justify or explain away the number of absentee ballots that were kicked out of the system for Asian Americans? I would say a quarter of all those submitted, particularly in Gwinnett, were kicked out. 1 in 8 for African Americans were kicked out. That also doesn't help explain the poll closures that targeted Black communities and communities of color. If we're going to tell the truth, let's tell the whole truth and look at the whole thing.
What Bianca is saying there are what Stacey Abrams uses as her data points, and I have a problem with them. Those absentee ballot decisions were made at the local level, not at the state level. The Democratic narrative is that Brian Kemp was like personally going through, nope, not counting this one, not counting this one, nope, nope. And that's not remotely what happened. In fact, in many of these places where they talk about voter suppression because of absentee ballots being thrown out, they are Democratic election boards in democratically controlled counties. That's the truth.
So Gwinnett was democratically controlled?
Gwinnett's one of many counties, but the examples that are used are often in Democrat-controlled counties.
But Gwinnett at the moment is
was
not controlled
Republican.
By Democrats,
it
right?
still is look, Republican-controlled.
Look, all of these stories about these precincts being closed, when you started digging in, what you found out is they weren't Democrat and African-American precincts. They were often Republican and older white people precincts. They were being shut down, and they were being shut down because of Americans with Disabilities Act requirements, not because of any grand conspiracy.
So let's take a look then at what the Secretary of State, the current Secretary of State, has done, set the primary date. Bianca, March 24th, that's 3 weeks after Super Tuesday, the multi-state primary extravaganza. How does Georgia fit into this, especially when it comes to the Democratic presidential primary, which is going to be, you know, obviously the big show on the ballot?
That is a big question mark for me. I've never actually walk through this process myself on this side of things. But I would imagine that it might give Georgia a little bit more special attention, that while the focus may be on Super Tuesday for a time, that there will be a significant ground effort to make sure that the follow-ups to that will be very strong.
So in other words, it's possible that after Super Tuesday, Georgia could be the last stand for some candidate who may not have done quite as well on Super Tuesday, and so we would get attention. Is that the theory?
I believe so. At least that's my theory. I want to find some positivity in it.
Brian, the other factor here is Georgia needs time to get all its voting machines ready. Does setting the primary date a little later buy at least a little time, especially for local voting officials, to get everything in line and online?
Yeah, you were seeing some local voting officials who, again, were the ones who decided which ballots counted last year. Begin to speak out, Republican Democrats speaking out, saying, we've got to get a system in place or it's going to be too late. So that process is moving quickly. Now, I do think this buys us a little bit more time. It also makes us a little less high profile the further back you get. Now, granted, the irony may be we may be even more high profile potentially because we'll be pulled out of the pack there on Super Tuesday.
And the race may have narrowed by then.
The race may have narrowed. You saw late primary states that used to be completely ignored because the race was decided already get tons of attention in 2016. I remember watching the Michigan Democratic primary night when Bernie Sanders pulled off an upset win over Hillary Clinton and really upset the apple cart there in that nomination battle. That could happen here. And with Georgia's significant Democratic electorate now, in a state that Democrats at least see as purpling, this could get us a lot of attention. And we need to be ready for showtime when that comes. I have faith in the system. I have faith in the people who are making these decisions at the state level. We got to perform. Because let me tell you what, as a Republican, with a Republican governor and a Republican secretary of state, I do not want to feed the Democratic narrative that we're so incompetent we can't run an election, and they're going to make all these reasons about how it's not a legitimate election. We cannot allow that to happen.
But we haven't even picked the vendor yet.
It's coming.
And it's another, you know, strike against this Republican-controlled administration. I mean, even in the last several years, they haven't even been able to keep the voter data safe. And then pitching to a last-ditch effort to try to take Stacey Abrams' candidacy for governor and claim that the Democratic Party tried to hack their voting machines. Come on. Look at you.
The fact is, it's showtime. We are behind where I think any of us would want to be, behind probably where the Secretary of State and the governor would want to be. But the governor was Secretary of State before, so he had that job, I think, for close to 9 years because he finished a term in 2010.
Karen Handel's term.
Yeah, exactly. And so he knows what we need. He knows the work that's going to be involved. So I think he's probably going to have a hand in making sure that this is done properly and effectively and on time.
And there's always the possibility that if something does go wrong, there could be lawsuits. And
it doesn't matter. Democrats are going to sue the state no matter what we do. I mean, we could take a clipboard to every Democratic house and take their vote personally to make an account. And they'd be like, the guy came to my second step, not to my third step. So it was an attempt to suppress my vote.
I'm going
to
lay out this big, ginormous welcome mat for Brian Kemp to do the right thing.
Brian Kemp has done the right thing.
He
registered
more
voters than any Secretary of State in Georgia history. He created apps that so that you can register to vote right there on your phone. There's no excuse.
He also historically purged voters from the rolls.
He followed state law, which has been upheld by the Supreme Court because it is a system used in other states as well.
But, and correct me if I'm wrong here, hasn't he subsequently backed off some of those things in the Secretary of State's office?
As far as
exact match, for instance.
Look, I think we all can have a serious conversation about how we make the system fairer and maintain electoral integrity. Republicans want every legal voter to be able to vote. We want to make sure that every voter, however, is in fact legal.
Well, then I would invite Brian Kemp to allow this lawsuit to move forward without striking any more appeals and trying to get it tossed out.
In the middle of all this, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 ruling, found that federal courts have no jurisdiction to police partisan redistricting in states like Georgia. Brian, in our time here, you and I have seen Georgia Republicans on both ends of gerrymandering, first complaining about it when the Democrats ran the state, and then, after they took over, and thanks to technology, the Republicans did it better than the Democrats ever dreamed of doing it. So will this decision just make things even worse from a voter's point of view?
what this decision does is maintain the status quo. It has long been the position of the federal law and rulings that you can draw districts with partisanship in mind. That's why when you hear people in any state legislature talk about redrawing, they'll talk about packing Democrats or packing Republicans into a certain district or spreading out Democrats or spreading out Republicans. It's because you can't say we're packing black voters or we're packing white voters, bleaching a district, which, you know, makes it making it more white and therefore more Republican traditionally. You don't hear them talk about those things because it has long been illegal to draw districts based on race, but you can do it based on party. And of course, we all know what the overlap is. We all know what this is code for. But you've got to be careful to use that code language when you're discussing it. And both sides do it. This is not a Republican thing, Democrat. This is how we're all forced by federal law to talk about this. So there's been a lot of leeway for states to draw districts as they see fit. It is one of those 10th Amendment carve-outs that has been respected through the years, that states get to determine how they draw those seats.
And now, their legislatures can do it for partisan reasons.
Absolutely. And you see Maryland doing it for Democrat reasons. You see Wisconsin doing it for Republican reasons, or Pennsylvania doing it for Republican reasons. So, not.
But does this open the door to just more of this? No,
because this is the status quo. This is how this has been the law of the land. And before Bianca makes it sound like I am for gerrymandering, I want to preempt that. I know it's coming. This is a bipartisan effort. Both parties do it. So this is not about Republican or Democrat.
It's a bipartisan effort to gerrymander.
Yeah. Nationally, both parties do it if they get the chance, period. That is. Mm-hmm. Indisputable. Here's the thing, though.
And that's why partisan gerrymandering must end. It must end.
And we as state voters can demand that. And that's where it needs to be done. If we want to change it, I agree the system is broken. Mm-hmm. I think this is why Congress can get nothing done. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to change it, the Supreme Court has just said, hey, you, state voters, fix it if you want to fix it.
Bianca, Democrats are at least thinking about perhaps one day they can flip the state legislature, one day within the next cycle or two. Will Democrats now, in light of this ruling, think, oh, okay, maybe it's not such a bad thing once we get in charge? But you do have, in the meantime, the 2020 census and redistricting pretty soon, perhaps before the Democrats can flip things.
I'll say this. I think the Democratic Party will take the state House before it takes the state Senate, which means that the maps will need to be bipartisan if there is, you know, a split chamber. Mm-hmm. I actually would kind of prefer it that way, and that they're both coming to the table and working together to get it done. And I know this sounds crazy with me being a party chair for the Democratic Party, but everything is not partisan. Everybody still deserves to have representation, and that is one of the principal beliefs of the Democratic Party. We're just hoping maybe some of these folks will come around to see it our way, but in the end, we do believe that people should have adequate representation.
Coming back to my earlier question, though, about the Senate, and Bianca, I'll start with you. Doesn't this highlight the importance of the Senate race here in Georgia because of the Senate's role in blocking President Obama's pick of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court and then the subsequent confirmations of President Trump's two nominees, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh?
It absolutely does. One of the ways in which we can have an impact on that is to get folks to turn out for the local races. It will have an up-ballot impact. So whoever the Democratic nominee is, if we're turning out our voters, then they will vote for the Senate nominee we've chosen.
Yeah, look, the Senate race is going to drive a lot of things in this state, at least more so than anything else below it. Obviously, the Trump and Democratic nominee race will be what drives most of what happens here in Georgia. I think Democrats and Republicans believe that whatever the margin is in Georgia, I believe Trump's going to win by probably 3 to 5 points. Democrats probably believe it's going to be a margin of less than 5, regardless of who wins. So it's going to be tight, and that's going to drive a lot of this. But the Senate is hugely important. Of course, David Perdue is tied at the hip with President Trump. one success is the other's success. One person's problem is the other person's problem in this race.
So why Purdue must go.
and holding that seat's going to have significant symbolic importance for Republicans.
And there was another Supreme Court ruling that we'll get to in just a moment, right here on The Political Breakfast. Stay right here.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And we are back with The Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Thanks for staying with us. Theron Johnson is out this week. Bianca Keaton is with us. She is the Gwinnett County Democratic Chair. Brian Robinson is back, Republican strategist. Let's talk about the Supreme Court ruling on the census question. Now, this was not an up or down on whether the question was constitutional. The court found that the administration's rationale for including it doesn't make sense. Sent it back to the lower court, said the administration can try to come up with perhaps a better explanation. Brian, we're looking at a real time crunch here, though, because the census forms are going to be out soon. Realistically, does the administration have time to come up with a new question, survive whatever challenges might come up before it, and get a favorable Supreme Court ruling?
I don't see how it's possible unless the Supreme Court were to step back in and approve the next thing. If it's got to go back through this federal court process, it's going to take too long. The stories show administration officials saying we would have to have this decided and in concrete by the end of summer. That, of course, is rapidly approaching less than three months from now.
The Supreme Court is ending its term. It's not coming back till October.
Exactly. So just on a practical standpoint, it is unlikely to move forward. I thought that the dissents in that case were very interesting and persuasive, that this is not something for the courts to be getting involved in, determining whether or not the administration's rationale is sincere or not. As Justice Thomas said, that's not our role. You know, our role is the rationale put forward good enough? And in this case, according to Thomas and several other justices who signed on to his dissent, yes, it was.
So you're saying the court should have ruled up or down on the constitutionality of the question itself?
And let it go forward. Yeah, I think that this is something that should fall within the discretion of the administration. Yes.
So the administration's stated reason for adding the question
was the Voting Rights Act.
Was to help enforce the Voting Rights Act that's a good enough reason to gut and many of their administrative decisions. But the real reason was to help, quote unquote, Republicans and non-Hispanic whites.
Now, this that was
not in official documents. That was written by a political operative whose files were opened after he died. I mean, so it's not, and this was just an outsider who was advising the administration. That was his opinion. Those are not official Trump administration positions or reasonings.
And just to clarify for folks who haven't followed this minute by minute, this was someone who was brought in to help develop things, and he was a Republican operations guy. And he said this is one reason to do this question. But Brian is saying, okay, that wasn't an official thing that the Commerce Department and Secretary Ross actually put forward. This was just a piece of advice they got.
It may not have made it into official documentation, and probably because it couldn't stand on its face. So you come up with another reason to mask the real reason that you included it at all.
Many policy decisions have some partisan overtone or repercussion. And certainly the census conversation is one that's got a partisan repercussion. When I was a staffer in Congress for Congressman Westmoreland, who sometimes fills in for me here on this show, mm-hmm. We were going into the 2011 census effort, and Lynn was leading the effort amongst Republicans to do an exact count. because the Democrats wanted to do one that was sort of estimated the total of the population, because it would, the estimates are bigger than the exact count because you don't get responses from everybody. So that is a conversation where you can make constitutional and legal arguments on both sides. But Democrats were trying to get more Democratic districts and Republicans were trying to maintain more Republican districts. That was the underlying current for both.
In the meantime, Bianca, because of this, because there are so many voters in minority communities, not only Latinos who've gotten the most attention, but perhaps Asian immigrants in places like Forsyth County, where the population of that community has soared in the last decade or two. Is this going to mean, because the citizenship question is not on the census, that Democrats or advocacy groups are now going to really redouble their efforts to get immigrant communities counted, because then they can say, look, that you don't need to fear anymore?
Exactly. At a time when immigrant communities are being targeted in a way that I have never seen in my lifetime. And just this past weekend, it was said that there were going to be raids, you know, in the metro Atlanta area. You have people afraid to come out of their homes. And then you ask them to identify whether they're a U.S. citizen or not. That is a loaded question. Because even people that are legally in this country that are immigrants sometimes are targeted and have found themselves deported.
So will we see, perhaps with a political aim, census education efforts aimed at immigrant communities?
Yes. I think you will see a whole lot more of that. But there also has to be something more said for the actual targeting that has been happening and what it means for these families.
Brian, meanwhile, Cobb and Gwinnett counties both recently renewed their participation in the controversial 287G program, which lets local law enforcement check the immigration status of anyone they detain pretty much for anything, or at least as long as they're charged, if they think the person is here illegally. Gwinnett County Sheriff Butch Conway and Cobb Sheriff Neil Warren are both in jurisdictions where the political winds are shifting for Republicans. Whatever one thinks of the immigration justification for this or the immigration enforcement justification for this, politically, was that smart?
Not every decision is a political decision. And I think that the voters who support them, their base voters, strongly support those programs. And it's not a matter of locking up people who commit crimes who they think are illegal. It's locking up people who commit crimes who are illegal and then holding them for federal authorities.
But they're deputized as federal enforcement agents, which is part of what the objection is, that suddenly they are an extension of ICE when the question is, should ICE just handle its own stuff?
Well, ICE doesn't have the resources to be picking up people who are driving under the influence in Cobb and Gwinnett or Whitfield County, where they have the program as well. It's a resource issue. It's a matter of us as a society. And as a, and by the way, that is federal law. That is federal policy, not Cobb and Gwinnett policy. That is how it's set up in the statutory efforts on the federal level. And it is a matter for this country of, are we going to be serious about deporting people who are here illegally, who have committed crimes, or are we not? That is what this comes down to. And what the sheriffs in these counties are saying is that, at least in our jurisdictions, we're going to be serious about deporting people who are breaking our law by being here and then breaking our law while here.
Bianca and Gwinnett, what's been happening in the immigrant communities?
I would say that quite the opposite is true. In application, that is not what is happening. There are a lot of innocents that are having their lives ruined behind this. And you can't look at the 287G question without looking at the broader issue of how immigration decisions are being made. There is a huge backlog that puts folks that have come into this country legally in a position where they cannot get decisions made on their status to stay here when they have built families and they have children in schools. And then,
and again, you're saying these are legal immigrants who are disrupted by this too.
Exactly. They have come here legally. And then to not be able to have the government make decisions on their ability to stay or to extend their time here, it forces them kind of into a status that makes them subject to be deported.
I don't know of any other country in the world that is as lax on this as we are, and it's still not enough for the Democrats. That any enforcement of our laws is just an outrage to them. The fact is, our neighbors to the south, our friends in Europe and Asia, they don't allow this sort of stuff, where people just come here and stay forever and are allowed to do that without any problem.
But isn't it a management issue, too?
Well, the management issue is when you look at who is allowed to come, and then it gets very, very preferential, very discriminatory, and biased.
I think you're overlaying race onto an issue that's got to do with nationality, not race. You're either an American or you're not. You're either here legally or you're not. And we've got to be able to enforce those laws or our laws become a joke.
Picking up on an issue that has been lurking kind of in the background after intense publicity in the last few weeks, the abortion law fight here in Georgia. The head of Third Rail Studios in Doraville, Dan Rosenfeld, talked to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and implied, look, you know, he and other industry leaders here in Georgia are sort of caught in the middle. We've had Spike Lee saying he wants the industry here shut down should the law actually survive a challenge and take effect. Meanwhile, Clint Eastwood is going to shoot the ballot of Richard Jewell here regardless. But no matter what Hollywood does or doesn't do, Bianca, is this something going into the election year that Democrats can say, okay, we're going to pick up independent voters here when independent voters cut both ways on abortion?
I think that we will pick up more voters around this issue. The film industry has really, really blossomed here. And there are a lot of families that are dependent upon that industry staying here and remaining strong and actually growing. And I think what you'll see is the film industry, majority of it, mobilize around getting people to turn out in support of Democratic candidates in the hopes that maybe there's something that we could do to overturn this or hopefully, you know, maybe push Brian Kemp to stop fighting back challenges to the law.
But is there a risk in making it a campaign priority when some of the voters that you're going after are independent voters, independent Republican voters who might be pro-life and might be more open to a Democratic message on other issues?
I don't consider this a pro-life thing, because if we were talking about pro-life, then we will be, you know, pro taking care of everybody, pro making sure everybody had freedoms, pro all the things that people need to have healthy and thriving lives. This is about robbing women of their autonomy to make healthcare decisions for themselves and their families. It's an issue that I see as a very personal one, because I know for me, myself, if I were to become pregnant again, it would be a life-threatening condition for me. I didn't realize that the first pregnancy would be life-threatening. So I feel this in a very personal way, that you cannot tell women that they don't have a choice in this matter.
I think that this has begun to calm down a bit, which, you know, we discussed this a couple of weeks ago, and I said that we would all be better off if we just let this simmer a little bit. And I think that we're getting there. We haven't seen a lot of these boycotts come to fruition. You're seeing less and less.
Some individual high-profile entertainers have said, yeah, we're boycotting Georgia. But yes, as you said, industry-wide.
Industry-wide, we haven't had this giant blowback, which is good. I would be very concerned if we had huge disruption to an industry that's become very important to us and a point of pride for this state. And the fact is we've invested in this industry, and it's a great place for them to do business. And I want to give credit to Stacey Abrams even, because I think while it was a bit self-serving, some of the stuff that she said in Hollywood, hey, just wait on me to win, was the underlying message of what she's... No, she said that. She said that. You know, changes are coming, and I'm the change. But she did at least stand up and fight for Georgia's economy, as has Brian Kemp. I'm glad to see that both of them are out there fighting for jobs.
Can
in
you tell
Georgia.
Me how Brian Kemp was fighting for the economy on this issue? Because if I remember correctly, he was ducking and dodging the film industry when they were trying to have a conversation with him.
What Brian Kemp has said is that the film industry and a pro-life culture can coexist, and he's out fighting for jobs. He's been in Seoul, South Korea this week fighting for jobs for Georgians.
Very quickly on another subject, and we're real short of time here, on a complicated question.
Okay.
Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms unveiled her affordable housing plan, $1 billion in public and private money. Now, this thing is a smorgasbord of incentives and zoning changes and a lab to explore new kinds of housing ideas, among other things. It's going to have to pass in pieces through city council. The feds will have to buy in, too. There are a lot of moving parts here, and critics say there are very few specifics. Bianca, Atlanta is hardly the only metro area jurisdiction with this problem. So are suburban counties, including Gwinnett, watching Atlanta, or are you guys trying to come up with things on your own?
Well, I wouldn't say that we're watching Atlanta. I would say that there have been conversations that have been going on for a very long time
long
on
time.
This issue. Yep. And you're seeing Atlanta take some of the first steps. Gwinnett will continue to have those conversations. When I was working for Lisa Cupid out in Cobb County for the Board of Commissioners there, those conversations were taking place. But it's also a conversation that takes place when you have representation. Cobb is very, very gerrymandered.
In terms of how the county commission districts
are drawn. And it does have an impact on how those policies are considered and explored. So it will be interesting to see how COP moves in the future. But over on the Gwinnett side, I'm very hopeful that this is something that we can push forward with, maybe taking some cues from Atlanta, but also exploring more broadly to find other counties that are leading on this.
This is a really tough one, and I want both of you to jump in on this, because it doesn't matter where you put one of the more interesting proposals, inclusionary zoning. The definition of that is still being worked out, but Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, not in my backyard or NIMBY, is mm-hmm. a universal thing. Mm-hmm. So how does one strike that balance?
I think it's unique to the community itself. You'll find that the zoning laws will vary across the counties, just like our election laws, why they're applied, you know, liberally, however they want to. But this is one of those areas where the community really needs to work together with the commissioners on it.
There's still a lot to be determined about this plan that she's put forward. Some of the critics that were quoted were saying there's not a lot of detail in this. And it looked to me like we still have to figure out how we get to this very large $1 billion figure. That's mm-hmm. that's a significant amount of public dollars going into housing. I think, however, that house price affordability is going to be one of those issues where we realign politically on the local level moving forward. Because if you look at San Francisco, just to take it out of our own
backyard,
everybody's a Democrat in San Francisco. But you're divided along class lines. You've got mm-hmm. these folks who can't afford a $2 million ranch mm-hmm. home, and you've got the ultra wealthy who already own the land, who don't want to see higher density, who don't want to see apartments put into their neighborhoods, who don't want to see a disruptive factor. And you're going to see it in some of these new cities around Atlanta, where part of what they're pushing for is to have local control over zoning, to keep out apartments so that you don't disrupt good school districts. That's kind of what they're thinking. They're trying to maintain the home values in those neighborhoods. And at some juncture, it doesn't matter what your party is. That's going to be defined by whether or not you own a home now or don't. And that's how we're going to be divided. And look, I think the Generation Z and millennial folks who are coming out with all this college debt, where are they going to go? Young people are getting a bad deal in America today, and I don't know how we fix it in a way that doesn't have perverse incentives or a government takeover of these sectors. I don't get it, but I know it's a problem.
Real quickly, because you're both wise political heads here, Mayor Bottoms made this a centerpiece of her campaign. If this stutters, stalls, doesn't quite get enacted quickly enough, because it's going to take time, at re-election time, is this going to be a problem for her, Or are people going to look at it and say, okay, she's making an effort? Is she taking a political risk here?
I think anytime you push for an ambitious promise or proposal of this sort, it is a risk. It's a political risk. I would hope that the voters would understand that she has made a lot of strides and gains for the Atlanta community. This is one that would take a significant amount of time. I do not know that it is something that can be completed in one term. This is something that she could potentially run for re-election on.
She campaigned on it. She's trying to make a difference in her community. She's trying to deliver on a promise. I don't think that she's got to have $1 billion in new housing units for low-income people in Atlanta to be considered a success on this when she goes up for re-election. I do think that she needs to show progress as far as this being a talking point on the campaign trail and getting this passed and getting a few things going that she can point to as progress. And one thing that she's talking about is sort of redeveloping sort of the west side where you have a bunch of aging infrastructure, open lots, places where the city owns a lot of land. Those are some low-hanging fruit where she can make an immediate difference and get some good housing in there for low-income people, middle-income people, frankly, people who have jobs.
And that is where Arthur Blank and his foundation have started some work as well, and obviously she has talked about partnering with him.
Love to see the public-private partnership there. I think it's going to make a huge difference. Because I don't have all the answers. I'm not a housing expert, but I do acknowledge that this is a repercussion of the huge gap between the haves and the have-nots. It's getting worse in this country. And I bring that up as a Republican because I worry that inequality is a danger to our democracy,
exactly,
which is number one for me.
We can agree on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We can agree on that. As a product of Chicago, I can tell you that, you know, the infamous projects all across where you concentrated low-income families, it does not work. So we cannot concentrate low-income families in neighborhoods and expect better results.
Very quickly, right before we go, let's talk about a little Gwinnett storm that continues. Gwinnett County Commissioner Tommy Hunter, who was reprimanded by his colleagues back in 2017 for calling Congressman John Lewis a racist pig in a Facebook post, is now suing for $5 million in compensation. At the heart of his argument, although there are a lot of other technical things that are part of it too, is a First Amendment issue that his colleagues were punishing him for exercising his First Amendment rights. Brian, I'm going to start with you on this one. In Gwinnett County, which is changing its party affiliation, at least if the demographics are correct, how much of a risk is this for Republicans, even if they don't support what Commissioner Hunter did?
It's not even in question based on demographics. Stacey Abrams won Gwinnett by about 16 points. Congratulations, Bianca. Yeah. it is now a Democratic county, and I think Republicans know that. I don't think Tommy Hunter at this juncture cares about the political and partisan implications. I think this is a personal grievance. He feels personally hurt. The points made in those cases are that this has hurt his ability to make a living outside of his part-time county commissioner job. And there may be some truth to that. There may be some sort of social stigma. Here's my thing, though. He was exercising his First Amendment right. He has every legal right to say what he said. That's why he's not been arrested. Mm-hmm. He's not been arrested by authorities. And at the same time, his colleagues on the county commission also have a First Amendment right to exercise what they think about his comments. Republicans and Democrat alike, including Commission Chairwoman Charlotte Nash, said that's offensive. That's not a reflection of this county or its leadership, and it's inappropriate. They have every right to say that, too. This should not be in court. The guy can complain about this, but he should not be suing.
Oh, my gosh. I could just jump up and hug you. Because this is another one that we're actually going to agree on. I think this is foolish. It's absolutely nonsensical. He has a First Amendment right to say whatever he wants, and he did that, and he made a fool of himself, and that is just what it is. His constitutional rights were not violated in any way.
And just how NFL players' constitutional rights are not violated if they take a pay cut or don't get playing time because they kneeled during the Star Spangled Banner. We have a right to say what we want to say without fear of arrest. We do not have a right to say whatever we want without financial consequence.
Amen.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for former Governor Nathan Deal. Filling in for Theron Johnson this time, Gwinnett County Democratic Chair Bianca Keaton. Thanks so much to you both. This has been fun.
Thank you.
Have a great July 4th week.
Yes.
And if you like this show, subscribe, and you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That is a great way to make sure other people can find us. We will find you. We'll be back in your feed soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.